The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. Today is the 8th of July, 2020. I'm sitting in the home of Diane Fairhead here in Adelaide. Thank you, Diane, for agreeing to meet with me today and to talk with me and to share some experiences. This recording is part of a program called The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. To start things off, Diane, could I get you just to state your full name?
Diane K. Fairhead, K-A-Y. And I was, when I served in Vietnam, Diane Skews, S-K-E-W-E-S.
Could you tell me your date of birth, please?
10th of June, 1944.
And your service number?
F45178. It's not something you ever forget.
Diane, could I get you please to start things off this morning, just to tell me a little bit about where you were born, maybe about your family and where you grew up, please.
Well, I was born in Unley, South Australia, Adelaide, a suburb of Adelaide. I was the second daughter to my parents. I did have a stepbrother who was 11 years older than me. So grew up mostly in Toorak Gardens, where my father had bought a house. Went to primary school there and secondary school down in Wayville, MLC as it was called there. Went to university from the year after I finished school. I had to fill in a year and I worked as a secretary to an optician because I wasn't old enough to start physiotherapy, but I started physio the next year and went through the University of Adelaide. And I guess as far as growing up, I had a very enjoyable and a very fortunate childhood. I think my parents probably, they really couldn't afford to send me and my sister to secondary school. MLC, I have no idea how they did it, but I think they probably took another mortgage out on the house and did it. But as a consequence, I am very grateful, but it took me a long time to be grateful, as one does. But I suppose the other part of my life revolved in those days around a church group. Not that I was madly religious, but it was a wonderful community, the Tusmore Methodist Church, and I played tennis and basketball and played the organ and went on camps and all that sort of thing as one did in those days until I got to university. And then doing physiotherapy in those days was very full time, so there wasn't a lot of spare time, but I always managed to play sport. And then when I finished physio, I worked in the Royal Adelaide Hospital for a year. In those days, there were only 17 of us that finished physiotherapy, so we could choose virtually where we wanted to work. There were desperate need for physios anywhere, and to work in a major hospital and go through all the rotations was the most amazing experience. So I was very fortunate to do that. So I worked for 12 months in the Royal Adelaide Hospital and then 9 months with a private practitioner and saved enough money to go to the UK by ship, like lots of people did in those days. I finished physio in 1965, would have been, because I worked for a year, 66, and then 67 I went to the UK.
And do you remember the journey well? Can you tell me what the journey was like?
Oh, it was a ball. It was a lot of fun. It was 6 weeks. The Suez Canal hadn't been opened, so we had to go around the Cape. So that took a little bit longer, but it was wonderful. I went on my own, so I, you know, when I think about it now, it was a pretty crazy thing to do, but I went on my own and made lots of friends and had a very active life. There was quite a lot of sport you could play on the ship, and it was just fun. I met people that I, you know, still friends with. And arrived in Tilbury, I think you arrived in those days, in London, and a Scottish friend who I'd made, she'd been in Adelaide for a while, she met me and I went and stayed with her flat in South Kensington for on and off for a year probably. I was very lucky, very lucky.
Must have been a great time to be living in London.
Oh, it was. It was fantastic, it really was. And having trained in Adelaide was the most amazing experience. And I mean, I enjoyed it while I was training and thought it was really good. But when I went into the Chartered Society of Physiotherapists in London, which is the place that you would go to try and get a locum somewhere, which is, you know, just to work short term somewhere, I remember fronting up there. And the woman said, oh, yes, Australian. And that, you know, Australians were thought of as very hard workers in those days and always very acceptable. And then she said, and where did you train? And I said, Adelaide. And she said, oh, yes, we'll have you. You can work anywhere. I know who you trained with. So I was given a couple of fantastic locums in Adelaide, in London. And then I did a few other odd things in London as well, but then I took a job in Scotland and ended up staying 9 months up there. I just loved it, between Edinburgh and Glasgow. But then eventually I thought I'm going to have to come back to Australia soon because I love it so much in Scotland. Am I going to live here forever or do I really want to be an Australian? So I came back to Australia. But that was hard, believe me, coming back, because my parents, my darling parents, wanted me to live with them. And after living a very carefree life for many, you know, a couple of years, it was quite tricky. But anyway, that's when I started applying for jobs all over the place and ultimately applied for a job in Vietnam.
It must have been some period of adjustment returning to Australia after...
I remember coming back and, I mean, I love my friends very much, but they all thought, because I'd had a pretty interesting time there and I'd left a fellow in Scotland, but I was not unhappy about that. But they obviously all thought I'd hurried back to Australia, but I hadn't in fact. But they kept, because they were all married and probably having their first child by then, it was poor Di, you know, we'll have to have... It was the days of the big dinner parties, and you know, get the dinner party and have someone. And I thought, it's the last thing on earth I want. Let me out of here. So I applied for a job in Darwin and Geelong, anywhere out of the state. But then I saw the ad for the one in Vietnam. Well, I did know it was Vietnam. I didn't know it was in the army. Have actually somewhere here got a little ad that I replied to, which was in our very simple South Australian Physio newsletter in April 1969, and it said, physiotherapists required urgently for work in Vietnam. Our office has been notified that one of our members is urgently required for 12 months duty in Vietnam, all particulars from the secretary. And there was a phone number there. Well, I had assumed that it... I don't know why, but I had assumed that it would have been with one of the civilian teams, which I think I would very much have liked to do because that was treating Vietnamese as well. Well, Vietnamese. But when I phoned up, they said, well, it's in the army, you know. I thought, this would be a new experience. So I phoned the contact person And they said, well, before you do anything, you would need to have a medical and a psych test to see whether you're fit enough to go. So I could have that in Adelaide, and I passed that. And then they said, you would need to go to Melbourne, to Vic Barracks in Melbourne, and be interviewed by the hierarchy of the medical corps, because a physiotherapist would go into the medical corps. And I said, oh, well, I'm going to Melbourne next week. My sister's just had a baby. I'm going over there anyway. You know, it was just incredible that everything just fell into place. So I went to Melbourne, and I rocked up at the barracks with these generals, not knowing what I was letting myself in for at all. I mean, I knew what was going on in Vietnam, even though in the UK you didn't get as much information. Anyway, I had the interview, and I think probably because I had worked in various places, and a lot of them pretty intensive and traumatic places, like burns units and intensive care in other places, I was deemed suitable. So at the end of the interview, they said, well, you'll do, you know, when can you go? And I said, well, hasn't anyone else been interviewed? Because, you know, I just walked in and been interviewed, and yes, can you go? I don't think many had been interviewed for it. I know of one other person. Anyway, I said, well, I could go after I go back to South Australia and say goodbye to my parents. I could go then, because I was completely fancy free. So that's what I did. I came back to Adelaide and said to Mum and Dad that this is what I was doing, and they just looked at me and they said, that's just the sort of thing you would do. So I then had to go up to New South Wales, to Ingawern, the 2 mil hospital. And basically I just had to go and to get kitted out, to get uniform, dress uniform, work uniforms, greens, and I should have been given a very thorough orientation, but I wasn't. None of the nursing staff going were very well informed about what they were going to, because I guess the hospital at that stage had only, there had been the field hospital was there, but not as the structure as it was when I went up there. And there hadn't been a physio there before, so they really didn't know what I was going to. The only reason they wanted a physio was because successive surgeons, who were usually CMF high surgeons from all of the different states, were coming back and saying that there were chest complications amongst the soldiers. Why were there? And then someone twigged that the other person that's in the team in an intensive care unit is a physiotherapist, that horrible person that comes in and makes people move when they don't want to and makes them cough when they don't want to and that sort of thing. And that probably is a fairly significant need for that. So that's what I thought that I would be doing. And that's basically the information I was given. So I had no idea what I was going to. But anyway, I was up there for about 6 weeks because they had to make the uniform. They didn't have any other females in the medical corps, so there was no uniform available. So it was all custom made, and I sat up there twiddling my thumbs. I could access the ward a little bit up there, but to be perfectly honest, the physio that was there wasn't too keen about me doing that because she'd missed out on going. She wanted to go up to Vietnam and she couldn't. So I spent a bit of time there and met a few people and got a tiny inkling of what army life might be like, because I had absolutely no idea at all. Absolutely, totally naive about the whole thing.
So how were you feeling at this point? Just after saying you had no inkling of what army life was to be like, how were you feeling? Were you, you know, was it exciting? Were you anxious? Was it?
Well, I think I was probably excited. I knew I was going to a place where I was needed. I mean, people would say, non-military people, you know, why on earth would you be going to a war zone? My friends thought I was stark raving mad. But I said, well, they need a physio. I'm looking for an interesting job. Very interesting. So I went. So I think probably I was excited. And I know I became a bit frustrated when I had to wait for the dress uniform to come, and then they couldn't find a hat. So, you know, they managed to find a hat out of their 1944 relics and things like that. But, yeah, I think it probably excitement I was. I mean, when you're, 25 or something? No, 24 I would have been. And I'd been in all sorts of places, so it was just something new, and I was quite happy to put myself into another situation. And okay, it was a war, but they needed a physio, and I was a good physio, so I went. I was given a short-term commission as a lieutenant. I was concerned that I may have to stay in the army when I came back, and I couldn't see that I would want to, so I was given a short-term commission with the proviso that I could resign when I came back to Australia if that was my wish, and that's what I did. So really, my service life was very short. It was only about 18, 19 months, I suppose, altogether, 12 months up there and time waiting to go up and then fiddling around to get out. And it was totally voluntary, which is also a bit bizarre. Well, the friends that I've made that I found out since all joined the nursing corps, the Army Nursing Corps, so that they could go to Vietnam. It was, and that was voluntary. I mean, it's not as if they'd been in the Army for years and then had to go. They joined. So I guess they would have assumed that I would have been the same, but it's not something that I'd even thought of, really.
From the time of this particular advert, which was in April 1969, was it roughly about 2 months before you hit the ground?
Yeah, end of June I went, yes. So it was quick. And, you know, I think about what I must have done to my parents. Poor loves. You know, I'd been away for a couple of years and they thought I was home safely, and then I take off to Vietnam. But I think they knew that I was never going to stay in one place. I mean, life's out there for the taking, isn't it? So, and when you're that age and you've got no commitments, why not?
That's it. They don't want to hold you back.
No, they were pretty good. Yeah.
Can you reflect back on your very first impressions when you arrived in Vietnam?
Oh, yes. I think anyone and everyone who's... Although I had been through Asia before, but arriving in Vietnam on a Qantas charter flight, which is how I flew up, as one-on-one replacements, and all went up by a charter, the Qantas charter flight, was when the doors open, it's the smell that gets you, the smell of gasoline and the Asian heat, and not rotting, but the smell in Asia is so different to the smell here. But it was the aircraft fuel smell, because the Tonsonut airport was just lined with different sorts of military aircraft. Huge, masses and masses of them. I mean, it was all new. But it was, you know, that's what was happening. And I guess I trusted that even though I didn't know what I was doing, somebody else must know that, you know, there was this lone female medical corps person that had to be collected and taken off to Vung Tau. And sure enough, someone found me. And I then went on another aircraft, a smaller one, to Vung Tau, where the hospital was. But it was, all totally, totally different experience. But I had, as I say, I had stopped off in Thailand, coming home from the UK, and also on the way up, the Qantas aircraft stopped in Singapore. And at that time, for some reason, some government edict, we weren't allowed to look as if we were going to war. So the guys had to take their shirts off and put a leery shirt on over their khaki gear, and I had to go down to the loo and change and put a dress on. So that we got off the aircraft and went in, and I don't know, maybe we had a meal or something, but it, while it refueled, but we couldn't look like we were going to war. And then you get back on the aircraft and they put their military stuff back on, and I put my uniform back on. So we'd been in Singapore as well, so the smell and the heat, but it was hot, yeah.
Was it really obvious that everyone was...
Oh, yes, of course it was. I mean, all these guys in khaki trousers and shiny black shoes in Singapore, I mean, who wears that sort of thing?
Do you reflect and think back about these times a lot?
No, I don't. Many things have happened. I probably didn't think about it at all for many years, and partly because there wasn't anyone who'd had the same experience. I mean, these sort of experiences that are so completely different to maybe what the general population has had, it's really good to find someone who's had a similar experience and you talk with them. And I have now got a couple of very good friends who were in the nursing corps who worked in intensive care when I did at the same time. We get together every now and then and we have that shared background. But no one had a physio background. There was no one that I could talk to. No one. I mean, my friends would say, oh, how was it? And they really wanted an answer in, you know, a few sentences, no more than that. But I was, I felt it was totally incapable of answering a question like that without, you know, going on for hours. Because, and then really, you couldn't do it because no one can conceive what it was like. You just couldn't. Mm-hmm. So I just didn't talk to anyone. As I said in the book that Honor Wilson wrote about physiotherapists, I said I just put it away in my mind, just locked it up and left it back there. The first time, and also came home and had three children, you know, got married and had three children and followed Fred around, even though he was in the army, still I was medical corps, and that's very different to, you know, the fighting part of the army. But I guess that I maybe thought about it a bit more. It wasn't at the coming home parade in Sydney. I didn't go to that. But there was next, and I can't remember, I'm hopeless with dates, but there was another big parade in Canberra that Fred and I went up to. And I met up with quite a few people from the hospital. And then it was after that a association, I guess, was created of, it's called the Vampire Association because that was the name of the helipad, the hospital. But it was an association of the first Australian field hospital. So that we didn't have meetings, but we had a reunion every few years, and that's still going. So that, you know, get together with people with similar experiences and then you reflect on it. But the rest of the time I don't. I was working in different places as Fred was moved from posting to posting, and mostly people had no idea that I'd been to Vietnam. I didn't see any need for them to know. Occasionally, you know, something might happen, and they would, but there was still a bit of antagonism. I mean, there certainly was for quite some time, you know, in the community. And there was no kudos in having gone to Vietnam. You were just thought of as not the nicest of people, probably. I mean, it was a lot more uncomfortable for a lot of the soldiers, but I could see there was no advantage in letting people know, so I didn't.
Did that slowly evolve over time?
Oh, yes. I think In over the last 10, 15 years, there's been a huge amount of interest in, you know, what you did and where you went and that sort of thing. And in the Vietnam War itself, and certainly a lot of younger people, school age, like the girls out at Kildare College, you know, were fascinated to know why you went there, what you did, and who did you meet, and all those sort of things. They loved all that sort of stuff. But, you know, that was just part of my life. We had a very busy life after we got married, so I was totally involved in family, really. Rearing three children under 20 months away from any family support's quite time-consuming, really.
Wow. Can I ask you the question of how do you think that experience helped shape your life or the way you viewed life and approached and tackled occupations and just things in general? Did it have a big effect?
Oh, yeah, I think definitely does. I think cement your values very quickly about what's important. I mean, there have been many books written in latter times about not sweating the small stuff, but really, once you've been in a war situation and seen people injured, seen people, the Vietnamese people surviving in that country, you just know that, you know, family and friends and your health are the important things. Having lots of money and buying new chairs and a new dinner set or clothes were unimportant. And the other thing I remember thinking when I came home was that why do people eat so much here? They eat far more than they need. I can remember it really, really worried me that they ate so much because you don't need it. I mean, we still do it, and I do it now probably, but, you know, people survive on so little when the life is so precious in a war situation. And I think probably also I was, as a negative, probably a bit intolerant of people who were fussing about what I considered unimportant things, you know, small things. And I can see now that that's not right, because if the small thing involves you, that's your small thing and that's important to you. But in the grand scheme of things, it's not really important. But I know I was intolerant. But I think, I mean, I'd always been reasonably non-materialistic, and I think it just made me more that, you know, you can get by with a lot less than you need to as long as you've got some family around and friendship. So I suppose, yeah, I suppose that's the main things. In the military, as opposed to the civilian teams, we only treated soldiers, Australian, New Zealand, occasional American, and very few Vietnamese. So our interaction with the Vietnamese was very limited. And there was, we could go into the local markets, but we'd have to go in a military jeep and be back before, you know, curfew and all that sort of thing. But we weren't really allowed to interact too much. I went a few times to an orphanage. I wish I'd gone more, but I guess I didn't have the time. But we couldn't really, if we were going further afield, like up to Nui Dat, where the, you know, the battalions were, we had to fly. We couldn't go by land. None of the females were allowed to. So, sadly, we didn't have much interaction, which I was sad about for a very long time, and always wanted to go back to see, you know, just to experience life there now. Anyway, I've been back three times since, so I have. But I think because in Vung Tau, which is where the hospital was, you could never really be sure whether they were pro or whether they were the enemy or not, because they might be serving you in the stall during the day, but that night they might be giving provisions to the Viet Cong, and this was a well-known fact. So we were, the females were, I mean, we were obviously incapable of looking after ourselves at those at that time, I don't know, but we didn't have much interaction at all. We had kitchen staff and cleaning staff or Vietnamese, but they didn't speak any English, so, and I didn't speak any Vietnamese, so, yeah. So sadly, it was an isolated base in, you know, a country that we didn't have a lot of contact with. A lot from the air. I saw a lot of Vietnam from the air, but that's not the same.
How did it from above?
Beautiful, lush. I was, because I was medical corps, I was not absolutely beholden to the matron who was the head of all the nursing staff. The CO of the hospital was my superior officer. And he was very, he wasn't lenient, but he was aware that I needed to interact with other physios or other physical therapists. So I occasionally went up to Saigon by helicopter. I went to a big conference in Trang, which was organised by this Korean physio, but these were all American physical therapists at a big American hospital, but then we looked over the Korean hospital up there too. But I went by a caribou up there, and we stopped off in quite a few. It was called the Milk Run, the Wallaby Milk Run. So it was dropping off supplies, picking up things all the way up, and it was way north, way further than any of the other females had been. But the CO was very good to me. He understood that, you know, it was probably my professional isolation could be reduced a bit if I, you know, had contact with others. There had been another American hospital in Vung Tau when we arrived, but that closed up quite soon afterwards. So, you know, it was a trip to go and see one, to see physios anywhere else. But it's, yeah, and flying up along the coast. Coast is beautiful with old French villas on the edge of the water and fishing villages. And Vung Tau itself had had a very strong French influence as a, I suppose it would have been a holiday place for them. But some of the old buildings and the feeling is like old French colonial places. So, yes, the French influence is there. It's still there.
You mentioned that you've been back three times since. How was that? How did that feel, going back to revisit?
Well, it's interesting. I, as I say, I'd wanted to go back for ages, but Fred just was adamant that he didn't. He didn't want to go back. He was still not in a good place. So one of my friends who'd been a sister up there, she was quite keen, and I found that there was a WEA, you know, the WEA in Adelaide, the Workers' Education Association. They do trips, and they were doing one to Vietnam, and some other friends were going, and I thought, I could do that. I'll ask Annie and see if she'd like to go, and she was really keen. So we organised to go, so we booked, and I think I'd paid my money. And then this Friday night we went down to Fred's Regimental Association down in Glenside, and some of his mates were saying they were getting together to go to Vietnam. Would he be interested? And he just showed a glimmer of interest. And I said, but I'm going, you know, I'm going in... I was going at the It was December, January, over that period, and that this group wanted to go 6 months later. And I said, well, the climate will be different and we'll probably see different things. You know, I wouldn't mind if you would go, because I thought if he says he'll go, this will be, a healing thing for him to go back and layer another layer of memories over the bad ones and see life going on, seeing that what on earth was it all about, reinforce that, but and layer that good memories over. So, yes, he agreed to do that. But the very first time I went back with this nursing sister friend of mine, and we had nothing to do with any military thing at all. If the tour said they were going to the Chu Chi tunnels or to a museum, war museum, we said, no, we're going out for coffee or we'll go and do a walk in the markets or something like that, because we wanted to see what, life was in Vietnam, not post-war, not the post-war sort of stirring up anti-American feelings. I mean, once they found out we're Australian, it was fine. If they think you're American, they weren't very happy. But I was really pleased to go back to see life, and I think it just reinforced, as I said, what on earth, were we doing there? Is their life so dreadful? Or just for the common person, for the general people? I don't imagine being communist or being non-communist was very different. I know it was very different for a lot of people, and they were forced to leave. But in North Vietnam, I loved Hanoi. It was it was the French influence, I suppose. And I like markets and all that sort of thing. So, we had a ball. And then we went back with Fred, and then we've been back another time to see other parts of Vietnam. So it's been, it's good. I'm glad we've done it. We won't go again, though.
So how were the facilities for you to utilise? Was it at times primitive? Or?
Well, when I arrived in Bung Tao, the CEO of the hospital met me. And I guess I was given time to go and put my things in our quarters, which were huts behind sandbags, with one shared shower for how many nursing staff? There were probably about 20 of us all together. I could get the numbers, but I'm not sure. There were three Red Cross people, girls, and nursing staff, the matron, me. They were pretty primitive, but I dropped my stuff there, and then he went over to the end of a Nissen hut and said, well, this is where your outpatient department will be. And I said, oh, outpatient department. I didn't realise that I'd be setting up an outpatient department. No one had told me that, I don't think. So, yes, well, you have an outpatient department, and just work out what sort of equipment you want and we'll get it from the Americans. Right, okay. What sort of people will I be seeing in my outpatient department? I have no idea what sort of people. It was sort of all up to me, and I thought, well, I'll probably be seeing people with sore knees and sore ankles. They'll damage that. Sore backs. And I was told that I'd be seeing soldiers that had been injured, having minor injuries like gunshot wounds, but just minor ones. Not the bigger injuries, the dreadful mine incident injuries, were usually medevaced home, because anyone who was not able to get back to full fitness and go back to the unit within 6 weeks was medevaced home. So the others, I had to set up this physio department for. So it was pretty primitive, but it had enough. It had enough there. I had, I don't think I was really wanting for anything. But hot, steaming hot, a few fans in there. isolated, slightly isolated from the rest of the hospital with no covered way. So in the wet season, you had to get everything done by 4 o'clock when the rain came, otherwise you'd be isolated. But you got used to it. But what gets me now is the crazy clothes we had to wear. I mean, look at these stockings and lace-up shoes and a starched dress uniform with a belt and things. No one wears that sort of thing in the tropics. It was much, much more comfortable when we were able to wear greens. And this is, that's three of the nursing staff there with their greens on. And if there was a red alert where there was a possibility that a rocket might land on the hospital, we had to wear greens and carry a helmet with us, and they were lovely. They were much more comfortable. I mean, they were GP boots, but once you've got your GP boots on, they're very comfortable, and it's much better than wearing stockings and lace-up shoes. That's myself and one of the Red Cross girls in our greens about to go off somewhere in a Iroquois helicopter.
Do you remember that moment?
That moment, no. No, I love helicopters though. I spent, we did go in helicopters a lot, and I remember the sound. There was this massive Vietnam veterans on an oval. I can't even remember what oval it was in Canberra. Noise, you know, chitter-chatter, and then in the distance you could just feel the vibrations. And then eventually hear the helicopter, and there was absolute, it still makes me go goose pimply, absolute silence as the helicopter came in. Because the Iroquois helicopter, or to the hospital, it meant incoming wounded, usually, although we did use it for being transported about. To the soldiers, it meant, you know, dropping of provisions or winching out of a dust-off helicopter, winching people out. But the Iroquois helicopter, that sound, we don't hear them round anymore here, but you could just feel it long before you heard it. And it was the most eerie thing that day in Canberra, when this silence while the helicopter went over, while everyone went into their own private space. Yeah, really, really spooky. This is not good because it's not a coloured photograph, but there's a really good tale that the engineers found this beautiful old citron in a rubber plantation, almost destroyed. I think it was the engineers that were up there when 6RAR were there. Anyway, they sent it down to Vung Tau, and it was refurbished, put together and painted a beautiful, beautiful pink, and handed over to the nurses at the hospital. But it was a really old citron that was very, very tricky to drive. And fortunately, there weren't many that could drive it. But I think we were there were two others as well who could drive it. But we'd obviously been somewhere. We used to take it down to the beach. But the beach was, you know, surrounded by barbed wire. Sounds like we had a ball, but you know, you worked really hard when you needed to, and then we could have a bit of free time. I worked 6 days a week, and then I would, if there weren't people in intensive care that needed treatment 4-hourly, I'd have Sunday off. But normally my day started at the ward round at 7:30, I think, and would finish 5:30, 6 o'clock. So they were pretty full days. But if there wasn't work to do, you know, if we didn't have a hospital full, you could go down to the beach. RNC Recreation and Convalescent Centre was down there, so that the soldiers had come down. So there were all sorts of things. There was a pool and tennis court and little tiny sailing boats down there. And we could use those too. This here is a photo of the Runnymede, it's a postcard of the Runnymede in Penang. Everyone who went to Vietnam had an R&R. I spent my R&R in Hong Kong. But being the females, we were able to have another week period, 1 week period, out the country, and we went to this Runnymede, which was then used as a British officers' mess. We went there, and I remember the sheets didn't smell. They were white. They didn't smell. There was frangipani everywhere. It was a double-storey place, as you can see, and the frangipanis were all around the edge. And there were geckos all over the walls, although we did have geckos in Vietnam. I had a gecko in my room. But it was just beautiful to get away for a week. And that's the place that we went to. Two went at a time. We went away together. It still exists, apparently. I think it's been done up as a very swish hotel. It could have been, you know, very colonial. Big, gorgeous, dark wooden floors and big pillars everywhere. But I guess it was good to get away. But it was interesting actually going there. I remember I wrote to a friend in Adelaide and saying that I just had a week in Penang, and it was absolutely beautiful. I loved everything about it, and I got a reply sometimes later. She'd apparently been to Penang too, from Adelaide, and thought it was the dirtiest place she'd ever been to. And I thought, well, that just shows where you're coming from. If you're coming from Vietnam to Penang, it was sheer heaven. Going from Adelaide to Penang, a bit different.
Very different. Yeah. Comparisons.
Yeah. Well, as I've said many times, it was one of the most amazing experiences in my life. To work in the hospital as a member of the team of top-rate surgeons, physicians and nursing staff, to work in a team that you knew when the siren sounded and the helicopters came in, that within probably 20 minutes from being injured, 20 minutes to half an hour, they would be on the vampire pad, and they would be in triage, then theatre, then into ICU. The extraordinary statistics of 98 point something guys survived their injuries once they arrived at the hospital. And that is absolutely incredible. And it was just the fact that everyone there totally focused on one thing. You couldn't be thinking about your family. I mean, you didn't think about your family. You had contact, but only by letters in those days. So the total focus was on the patients, the guys that came in. So to be part of that team was just amazing, and you could never replicate it anywhere else ever. That was amazing. And I guess the other amazing thing is I met Fred up there, my husband, so that's pretty amazing, at what was laughingly called a garden party for one of the returning battalions. I met him in a rubber tree plantation.
Can you elaborate a little bit on that? First meeting?
The 2IC of 6RAR used to come down to the hospital to see the wounded soldiers, and he would stay, well, he'd either have a meal, some sort of meal, in the mess, and I guess everyone was starved of female company, and he was a lovely man, and I got to know him quite well. So he was a delightful New Zealander who was a friend, a dear friend, until he died. When we went up to this farewell for the battalion, he said, "Come on, Di, I want to introduce you to the battalion poet." And I thought, "Oh, what's this all about?" And he says, "It's because he tells lies all the time." But he was the intelligence officer who had to brief. You know, he'd get all the intelligence and brief people, as he would tell you. And he said he makes it all up. He didn't at all. But anyway, he introduced me to this skinny fellow leaning up a tree drinking red wine out of a copper goblet. And I thought, oh, here we go. It's someone a bit different. Anyway, he then, whenever he could, which was very seldom, if he came down to, he'd get a chopper down to Bung Tao, and you know, we'd meet up. So it progressed a bit, and we used to, or he, when he was in Nui Dat, he'd try to phone me, which was quite fascinating because it had to go through two exchanges. And it's like living in the country years ago. Are you getting through, you know, Captain Fairhead, is it okay? You're getting through all right? And you think, yeah, you should be listening to the whole lot. So that was quite funny. But, and then he, the battalion, his 6th battalion left. He came home, and he was home for 6 weeks before I came back. I flew back to Sydney. He was in Perth, and he drove from Perth to Sydney to meet me. And we got married as soon as we could after that. Wonderful. So it was a life-changing experience in many ways.
Diane Fairhead, thank you so much for sharing a few stories and experiences with me of your time in service in Vietnam. And it's been a privilege to meet you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
You have been listening to The RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2020.